This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. On the show this week, the PC leader says new Premier Ian Rankin's off to a good start, but Tim Houston says he wants that job after Nova Scotians go to the polls in the next election. Parks Canada dials in to share some interesting stories about Alexander Graham Bell, and a local musician talks about his three ECMA nominations. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Mike McKenna Jr. is a singer-songwriter originally from Glace Bay who's entertained audiences all over North America with his unique sound and storytelling, often paying tribute to his native Cape Breton. In one review, writers for the website Americana UK said, "His music is a peephole into a world we know little of and a thoughtful comfort from beginning to end." And now Mike's up for his first ever East Coast Music Award nominations. Here's his conversation with Dialogue's Dave DeVoe.
Now that we're on the record, I guess I'll just say congratulations on the ECMA nods. How are you feeling about that?
Thanks so much. I'm pretty excited. It's my first time being nominated. And to get three was kind of a shock, actually, so I feel great.
Three was a shock for you?
Yeah. One was for a Video of the Year, and another for Contemporary Roots Album of the Year, and another for Rising Star. So,
okay, which one of those in particular surprised you?
Maybe the album of the year one. You know, Rising Star. I guess, you know, I'm still an emerging artist, so that one wasn't as much of a shock. With the Contemporary Roots album, is some artists that I've really looked up to for a long time. So it's a category that feels really good to be a part of in that way.
So I know you're based in Montreal now. Is that correct?
I've been based in Montreal for quite a while, but I actually moved back to Cape Breton in August at the end of the summer.
Okay.
I've been back home for a while.
Yeah, that's a good segue, actually, because I know so much of your music is based in Cape Breton. I know I was just listening before, I heard the references to Number Two, so I take it you're from the Glace Bay area?
Yeah, I am. I was born in Glace Bay, and I lived there till I was six, so I did my first year of school at St. Anne's. I would have gone to the town daycare in Number Two,
okay,
even before I went to school. So, and my grandfather was a counselor for Number Two.
Okay, interesting. So, where did your life course take you after Glace Bay?
We moved out to Myra. My dad built a house out in Albertbridge.
I would have
gone up out here, and I would have went to school at Myra Road and Malcolm and Riverview.
So
I maintained my connection to Glace Bay through my family. My grandparents lived there, and my mom was a physio there and had a clinic there. So I would work at our physio clinic and spent a lot of time in Glace Bay growing up. I'd even play rugby and football out of the hub field in Number Two as well.
Yeah, I'm from New Waterford, but I have sort of a connection to Glace Bay. My grandfather was in the Number 26, which was close to the Number Two, I believe, where I think you might have said you've had relatives work there, did you? Yeah.
My grandfather was a counselor for Number Two, Ronnie Burroughs. He represented the working class. He was a working class guy himself. Worked all kinds of different jobs and very outspoken guy. So he was a real community man. He was really proud of that area. So.
Yeah, and that's really reflected in your music. You're really trying to capture the working class experience and tell those kinds of stories in your music. Tell us a little bit about just what inspired you to do that, to take that lyrical route.
I really found that the stories of Cape Breton were really unique and somewhat undertold. Like I found that growing up, we were, as Canadians, heavily influenced by American stories. And I just really wanted to write songs that reflected my home region. And the more time I spent away from Cape Breton, I guess the more I reflected on it. So I would have gone to New Brunswick for university, and then I moved to Australia and traveled around there for a year, and I've lived in Asia. And all that time, I really started to understand my identity as a Canadian and a Nova Scotian and a Cape Bretoner, and it made me more and more interested in that history. So I went back and I got lots of stories from my family, and that inspired some of my first songwriting. And then that kind of led me to digging a bit deeper and doing more research myself. And I didn't really know that would become a big part of my style, but it's something I started to really enjoy as I went deeper.
And what are some of the stories that you've researched that have sort of resonated with you most deeply?
There's a song on my new album, At the Edge of the World, that that's called The Wolf. And that was one that was actually from a publication called the Maritime Labor Herald. So it was some socialist workers' rights writers from
Was that
Gray
McLaughlin's, J.B.
Yeah,
McLaughlin's? Okay, okay.
Exactly, and Don Fraser.
And
so I found the writings really interesting, and it had that spirit that I grew up hearing from my grandfather, and, you know, and I definitely didn't realize that there was this kind of socialist, communist story in Glace Bay, and obviously to do with the rights of miners and steel workers. So, I found it really intriguing. Roy the Wolf was the name of this kind of despised CEO of BESCO. British Empire Steel Company. And basically, Don Fraser wrote this really scathing poem of him in the Maritime Labor Herald, and it was really this, almost like, it was a smear piece in a way. But it was very clever the way it was written, and I ended up turning it into a song. So sometimes when I write a song and it kind of leads down a certain path, I like to write some other songs that associate with that. So that inspired a couple other songs on the album. And that was one that I really didn't see coming. I found this poem and I ended up adding some music to it, and we kind of did it ad lib in the studio, and it ended up working out really nicely and being a real dark track that sounded a bit different than everything else on the album.
Okay. Now, Roy the Wolf, he is of They Can't Stand the Gaff fame. Is that the person they're referring to, the guy that said the miners couldn't stand the gaff?
I'm not sure. I basically had read into him after I discovered this poem. I found that he was somebody that I guess was detached from the miners' experience, you know, and he was somebody that had a close connection with Halifax and kind of called in the heavies and called in the some I guess cavalry and some big guns, and they basically would squash the strikes of the local workers and be pretty abusive. They would actually chase them back to Whitney Pier and club them over the heads, and there was some pretty crazy stories involved with it. So it got very violent. So not only was he despised, but eventually he would really turn on them.
Yeah.
So I could see how he got a nickname like Roy the Wolf.
Yeah, for sure. And I know I'm just thinking back myself to reading David Frank's biography of J.B. McLaughlin. I don't know if you've read that, but it's a fabulous book. If you're interested in working class history, that's really a fabulous book. In-depth look at McLaughlin. But when I just heard your music recently, I have to confess. But as I listened to it, got me thinking of that, you know, McLaughlin and all the old radical miners and stuff. So that seems to be a sort of thing that stuck with you quite a bit.
Yeah, it definitely did. I guess I also explored my American heritage. My dad's from the United States. He's from Boston.
Okay.
And so I started traveling and touring and living down in the United States as well. And the more time I spent down there, I started meeting a lot of people from Appalachia that were incredible musicians, and they had a really particular music tradition, obviously, in bluegrass and old time and this old mountain music. And they told a lot of stories about the coal miners' experience. And it did really strike something in me. And, you know, I knew that I came from a coal mining town in Glace Bay, and we had our own stories to tell. And so I definitely was influenced a bit by that as well. And I like to put a little bit of that musically into my style, whether it's in the instrumentation and the use of banjo. You know, you'll hear a lot of long neck five string banjo on my records. You know, obviously that's not a traditional instrument of the Maritime. That's more of an American thing, an African American thing. So I definitely like to pull a little bit from all the different parts of my identity in my life. And of course, growing up in Cape Breton is definitely one of them. So.
Yeah, and of course there's another big connection there too, because the UMWA would have represented a lot of people in the Appalachians and in Cape Breton, right? And there's a long history of you know, miners traveling back and forth in that capacity between the two areas. So the connections are pretty deep there as well.
I think a lot of stories and a lot of music traveled up and down those mountain ranges.
Yeah,
in the southeast. Yeah.
I can imagine so, yeah. So tell me a little bit about some of the other songs on your record and some of the other themes you've explored in terms of the working class experience.
The first track on the record, I guess I could start there, it's the title track, At the Edge of the World. That was actually inspired by just a news article that I was reading one day in the CBC. And it was actually a man that was living in Cape Breton. He may have been from Newfoundland. But he was someone that was one of the rescue workers involved in the Swiss Air 111 crash.
Oh,
and basically it was a very traumatic thing for anybody that was involved in that rescue. And he talked about his experience and it got really deep and I've just found it a really inspiring story. And it was kind of it was obviously a dark job to go out and do this essential thing like retrieving the bodies that might be needed to be recovered from an accident like that. So.
Yeah.
Basically, I also found it to be a super unique experience. It was something that obviously, if you live close to the ocean, in a place like Nova Scotia, you're going to experience that more often than a lot of other places. So it kind of reminded me back to a few years ago when I was writing and researching for my album, Pacific Northwest Bound. I was at the Halifax Public Archives, and I was going through their documents and their records looking for old stories and old songs. And I came across the journals from the Titanic and started reading some of the things people were writing when they were doing basically the same job of going and retrieving the people that were lost in that accident. So reading this was really inspiring. I had taken a lot of notes from it. And when I came across this article about the Swiss Air crash, I realized it was kind of a modern version of the same thing in the same story. So that's where I drew the inspiration for my character in the song. And it definitely can be applied to probably a lot of different scenarios that were like those two accidents.
Okay, so you're exploring, I guess, the working class experience throughout, you know, a variety of industries, be it coal mining or in the search and rescue field, or
a lot of fishermen, I believe. It was local fishermen that had access to boats. You know, they were able to just jump in their boats and go out there very quickly, and they knew the area very well, so I think they got a lot of assistance from local fishermen. So, that was definitely something that was unique to Nova Scotia, or at least to coastal communities.
Yeah, probably resonates a little bit contemporarily, too, because there's been some recent tragic fishing accidents.
I just read about that the other day, and that was pretty sad to hear. So,
yeah.
Unfortunately, it is something that constantly probably occurs around here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it... mining, steel working, fishing—the areas sort of made a lot of its wealth on some really dangerous occupations. So,
absolutely,
know, as tragic as it is, one could imagine it would inspire a lot of songs like it has with you.
Sure, I think it creates a certain character in people around here, and a certain way of looking at life, and a certain. You know, that self-deprecating humor that you get in places like Nova Scotia or Newfoundland or Ireland, you know, so I can definitely see how it's kind of shaped the culture, local culture around here.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny, because, I mean, I know, you know, friends of mine and I will often joke about Cape Breton and its various drawbacks and stuff, but at the same time, there's a connection as well that's not trivial.
No, of course not, and that's something that I'm trying to explore, I guess, when I'm writing songs, how deep can I go on the identity and the experience here, and so it goes outside of myself and my own life, and it goes into looking at other people's stories and other people's experiences, and I'm kind of trying to explore more of that as well. I include lots of songs that are my own experiences in life, and I mix those in with my albums, but I try to find as many other people's perspectives to put in there as possible, too, to kind of even out my albums in that way.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Mike?
I guess not really. Thanks so much for having me. I can say that I have a few things coming up. I have the Canadian Folk Music Awards. I've been nominated for a Canadian Folk Music Award, and that's coming up on April 10th. So, and 11th, that's the awards gala. So if anybody wants to watch that, I'm sure it's going to be streaming live. I'm pretty excited for that.
Okay.
And ECMA's gala is coming up May 6th. So the exact same for that. If you want to check that out, that'll be streaming live, and I'll have a couple showcases happening in person live here in Cape Breton as well.
Great. Well, best of luck on that.
All right. Thanks so much.
This year marks the 145th anniversary of Alexander Graham Bell's telephone patent, but as we'll hear from Kelly DeVoe of Parks Canada, if it wasn't for the preemptive efforts of his partner and future father-in-law, someone else may have been the first to introduce the speaking telegraph to the world. Kelly also explains how the late Cape Breton resident and inventor, along with his wife Mabel, made their mark on this island and all over the globe in more ways than one. And she begins by talking about her work at the Alexander Graham Bell National Historic Site in Bedeque.
Well, I get to work with a fantastic team who shares the story of Alexander Graham Bell and his wife Mabel, and really inspires our visitors and helps them learn a little bit more about Bell, his life, his legacy, and some of the impacts and contributions that he made to many sectors through his inventions.
So he was born in Scotland, but he chose to live in Cape Breton to build a residence, and maybe he and his wife Mabel could have lived anywhere in the world, but they wanted to make their roots here.
Well, you're right. He was born in Scotland, and Bell made Bedeque his summer home, but spent a significant amount of time in Bedeque. The family built Benbrea, and Bell's activities there certainly had a significant impact on the economic and social life of Bedeque. So, for example, the estate at Benbrea provided work for many of the men and women in the community, both in a traditional service occupation role, but also directly connected to Bell's experiments, such as producing thousands of tetrahedral cells for his massive kites. And Mabel as well, she played a really important role, well, in her husband's career, both for moral support and financial support, but she was also very active in the Bedeque community. For example, she helped to establish a local library, the Home and School Association, and a club for young women.
Can you give a bit of a verbal tour of the National Historic Site there in Bedeque for anyone who hasn't visited yet?
Well, I encourage all of your listeners to visit us this summer. We're looking forward to a full season of operation. We open on May 21st, so May long weekend. And if you haven't been to the site, I think when you walk in the doors, you're going to be very impressed just by the visual grandeur of the space. It's a beautiful A-frame that sits on the hill in Bedeque overlooking Bedeque Bay and the lighthouse. It has a lot of windows and a lot of natural light, and the actual design was inspired by the tetrahedron shape that Bell used in his flight experiments. So the original A-frame museum opened in 56, and like I said, when you walk in, you'll be struck by the open space and the light. And once you move down into our exhibit area, there's many different areas that deal with certain aspects of Bell's life, and also his beautiful relationship with Mabel, his wife, his time in Bedeque. And some of the sections of the museum also inspire visitors to be their own inventors, especially children, when families visit. There's opportunities for that. When you continue along in the museum, you'll come to a great hall that we call the Water Hall, and there you'll be met face-to-face with a reconstruction of the Silver Dart, and also the HD4, which in its mere size is amazing to look at. So it really is worth a visit. And also sign up for a guided tour with one of our incredible staff who are very passionate about the Bell story and can really share some of the many facets of Bell's work and life.
So as you said, he was involved in many other inventions other than just the telephone, but this year marking a milestone, it's the 145th anniversary of his patent, and it's hard to imagine what the world would look like today without his invention.
Yeah, you're right. It's impossible to imagine a single aspect of our daily lives today in 2021 that's not impacted by the invention of the telephone. You know, when I think about, you know, we live on our cell phones and so many of us are working from home now, the impact of Bell's invention is almost more relevant now than it was 145 years ago. So it's an important milestone for us. We marked it on social media because it was in March. But because we do talk about the telephone in our programs and at the site, we will note that it is 145 years. And interestingly, when we talk about Bell's most widely known invention, like I said, he had an impact in many other sectors. But when we talk about the telephone in our programs and at the museum site, a lot of visitors find it very interesting when we share some tidbits about the patent for the telephone. So the patent almost didn't happen. So that's a bit of an interesting tidbit, in fact. It was February 1876, and it wasn't Bell who actually filed a patent for the telephone. It was his business partner and future father-in-law, Gardner Hubbard. So he actually filed an application for the patent on what was then described as the speaking telegraph. So it wasn't called the telephone then, it was the speaking telegraph. And he did so without Bell's knowledge. So as you can imagine, Mr. Bell wasn't too pleased, but then was rather grateful, because within just 2 hours of Mr. Hubbard filing that patent application, another inventor, Elisha Gray, filed a caveat serving notice to all other inventors that he too was working on a device for the transmission of speech by electricity. So that's quite remarkable when you think about it. Now, Bell's application was much stronger because he was already testing the workings of instruments, whereas the other inventor, Gray, was not. So because Bell's application, or the application his future father-in-law put in, was stronger, he actually did receive a patent on March 3rd, 1876, for the speaking telegraph. And then because he was already working on those instruments, it was only several days later, on March 10th, when that famous historic moment took place where Bell and his partner Thomas Watson were preparing to test the instruments they were working on, and then Mr. Bell accidentally spilled battery acid on his clothing, and he called out, "Mr. Watson, come here, I want you." But Watson actually heard it on the device they were testing in another room. So it's inspiring to, when you think about that, you know, that exciting moment. And Bell had dreamed of transmitting speech electronically several years ago, and now it became a reality, and he had worked so hard to get there. So Mr. Bell was inspired to invent and to create for the betterment of the world. And I know that sounds like a big statement, but there's this remarkable quote where Alexander Graham Bell said, "An inventor is a man who looks around the world and is not content with things the way they are. He wants to improve what he sees. He wants to benefit the world." And so I think that quote really speaks to Bell's motivation and drive for inventing. He was not driven by the commercial success of his creations. So I think that speaks more to the impact that his work was having. When you think about his work in aviation, his work in, you know, marine engineering, in medical science, you know, he really was driven by that desire to make the world a better place.
And he also did some groundbreaking work with someone whose name will be familiar to a lot of people, Helen Keller.
Well, Bell was actually first and foremost a pioneer in deaf education, and remained very committed and very passionate to his work in deaf education. And he did have a close relationship with Helen Keller, which continued for the rest of his life. And there's a wonderful passage in a book. It's called The Reluctant Genius, actually, by Charlotte Gray, where she talks about Bell and his relationship with Helen Keller and their first meeting. And Helen Keller, in some of her letters later in life, just attributes so much to Bell for seeing that potential. And it really was quite a special relationship that they held. And again, it was very much rooted in Bell's passion for deaf education.
And one of his contemporaries, Marconi, there's a National Historic Site here in Table Head in the Glace Bay area, and he's credited as being an inventor in radio, and he's behind the first wireless transmission from North America to Europe, and that was back in 1902. And so these gentlemen are responsible for technology that many of us simply can't do without today, and both of them have roots here in Cape Breton, and that's pretty remarkable when you think about it.
It is remarkable when you think about it, and exactly as you just said, there's so many facets of modern day technology that we simply cannot live without. You know, the power goes out, but we're still happy we have Wi-Fi on our phones or accessing our phones through data. It is quite incredible, and there are great stories, right? Great stories about invention, about innovation, about curiosity, about communication, about connecting people and people connecting with the world around them. And you're right, the roots are in Cape Breton. And that's exactly what we celebrate at both those sites. Parks Canada is there to share those stories, share that history, but also to inspire our visitors, anyone who walks through the door at Marconi or at the Alexander Graham Bell National Historic Site. We're looking to inspire visitors to think in that way, be inspired to invent, be curious about your surroundings, especially today. And I'll just share a little story about Bell's vision and how that's connected to today, not just in cell phones and Wi-Fi and those sorts of things, but it was 1921, less than a year before his death. And Bell was asked, what specific development should we inventors be focused on in 1922? And his response was very, very straightforward. He said, energy. And he said, we're running out of energy. We're running short on energy. He said, the coal and oil are going to run out one of these days, and we'll be without it. So we've got to develop methods for substitutes for those fuels. And when you think about that, like that was 100 years ago, and here we are looking for alternate sources of energy. And Bell was talking about that 100 years ago, and he was thinking and creating around that. And one of his theories, actually, was that organic waste, such as corn stalks and wheat chaff, were potential energy as alcohol for fuel. So that's 100 years ago. So it just goes to show that when you have that curiosity and that thirst for inventing, solving problems, making the world a better place, it's incredible what you can envision and come up with. And we hope that our visitors get a little bit of that inspiration when they visit our sites.
And it's interesting that for it to be suggested his work wasn't necessarily for his self-gain and to make the world a better place, and an excellent sign of humility. And there's a letter at the Marconi site from Bell to Marconi where he's congratulating him for his work and offers Marconi to use the Bell estate in Bedeck, and I think the staff too. A very nice offer, and Marconi was very thankful but declined. But such a nice gesture and a demonstration that he wanted to work with other people, like you said, to make the world a better place.
And that's Bell's style. You see that throughout the site in Bedeck and through our records, through his letters, through his notebooks. He was a collaborator. He really was. That's not the only example of times where he offered to work with other inventors of the time. And during that period, you know, there really was almost a race for invention and innovation. And that's it's very much like Bell. He encouraged and he fostered that innovative spirit in those around him. When he was in Washington, D.C., he had a bit of a weekly gathering of the minds of that time. And it was all about knowledge sharing and really supporting each other. So I think that, again, speaks to his, you know, he didn't necessarily have a competitive nature when I was speaking before about his, you know, his drive was not about the commercial success of his inventions. So the fact that he was so collaborative and had that spirit of working with others illustrates that as well. And the work on the Silver Dart is another example. Like that was a group of people. It was the Aerial Experiment Association, and it was great minds working together and supported by his wife, by Mabel Bell. She was inspired and she founded and then she funded the Aerial Experiment Association. So she played a big role in Bell's work too, and was a co-collaborator in many senses.
Of course, his estate is not far from the museum in Benbria, which I'm told is Gaelic for beautiful mountain. Is that right?
Yes.
Imagine for the people who are lucky enough to visit there, you're standing on Bell's lawn where some of his work was carried out by him and his wife Mabel. I think including the hovercraft. Is that right? Did he work on the hovercraft in Benbria?
At the site, we have examples of the HD4, and so that actually set a world record for being the fastest speed on water. And we have pieces of the HD4 at the site, and then we also have a replica, which is so impressive when you stand beside it and you think about how large and impressive that was to watch zip across the surface of Bedeck Bay. But yeah, Benbria, it was the Bell's home in Bedeck, and it is still in private ownership. The descendants of the Bell family maintain Benbria Hall and many of the other buildings there as well. The graves of Alexander and Mabel are located on the Benbria estate. There's no public access to this property, but it remains such a significant off-site resource for us because it is the scene of Bell's work, and it sets that stage and it provides the context for the exhibit that we have at the National Historic Site.
And, you know, I have to admit, only because it was mentioned, there's no public access to the site, but I was very fortunate to be invited there once, and it was just a matter of being in the right place at the right time, as simple as that. And I saw the gravesite of Mr. and Mrs. Bell, and speaking of the humility, it's certainly nothing fancy, if I remember correctly. I think it was just a very big rock. It was a long time ago, but do I remember that correctly?
I actually haven't been to his gravesite, so you're probably remembering it correctly. And I actually just flipped open a book, and you're right. That's exactly what it is.
Yes, and it would make sense you'd want to keep everything simple like that, and his willingness to share his work with other people. And I think he said Benbria reminded him of his home in Scotland.
Yes, he is. Quoted many times as referring to his homeland in Scotland and similarities with his home in Bedeck.
Does Parks Canada have a relationship with the family descendants?
We work very closely with the family on various initiatives. Again, you know, the site is there because of the family and the graciousness of the family to share Bell's work and records and life story. And so that began 3 decades after Bell's death and Mabel's. So their daughters, Elsie and Marion, they generously donated artifacts and authentic records of their father's work to the Canadian government with the intent that that collection would always stay in Bedeck. And in return, a building was built to house an exhibit. This work. So then it was in the 1950s that a parcel of land was purchased by the government of Nova Scotia, actually, from private landowners, and then it was gifted to the federal government for the building. So the original A-frame opened in August of 1956, and yeah, it continues to be a center for just the celebration and commemoration of Bell. And not just as a world-renowned inventor, but also, like I was saying earlier, his incredible relationship with Mabel, his wife, and their love story, their partnership, the contributions to so many sectors that he made, and then also the contributions that they made to life in Bedeck.
Okay, thanks for that. Is there anything you'd like to add? You mentioned earlier an opening date is coming up, and how can people learn more about the Bell Estate and the museum across the way in Bedeck?
Yeah, well, I encourage all of your listeners to visit us this summer. Great staycation. We do open May long weekend, so Friday the 21st, May long weekend. And I also encourage visitors to participate in one of our programs, because you really do get that one-on-one experience with our guides, and you have an opportunity to ask questions, and our guides are just so passionate and well-versed in the Bell story. And you get that rare glimpse at the site into not only the mind of a famous inventor, but also his heart and his personality and how his genius shaped the world, really. It's almost like you get to pull back the curtain and to peek into his life. And it is quite vast, his influence, you know, from flight to watercraft to deaf education to artificial respiration. He's left us quite a legacy. And for our visitors, I think that when they leave with that inspiration to ask questions and to think and to have that spirit of just bettering the world, you know, the time spent is well worth it. And it's just so beautiful as well, on the hill overlooking Bedeck Bay. It's a gorgeous location, and we offer kites, actually, especially for families, to fly kites outside in our picnic area in the back, up behind the museum, and just think about Bell when he was flying kites over at Benbrea, and he was dreaming about one day humans potentially flying as he watched his kites and did his experiments. So everyday activities can really inspire people to think about how they can change and better the world.
Provincial Progressive Conservative leader says he doesn't really have anything bad to say about the new Premier Ian Rankin, but Tim Houston says, make no mistake, he wants that job as provincial leader when Nova Scotians go to the polls in the next election. And he says one of the improvements you'll notice will be in healthcare. First question, his opinion on progress in the first quarter of 2021.
Pretty good, I think. I mean, look, it's everyone knows how different things are, but one thing doesn't change, and that's when an election's in the air, people's senses are heightened, and certainly there's an election in the air here provincially. So as a party, we've been very focused on preparing for that election, making sure that we're putting out policy, actual solutions. I mean, I'm the leader of the opposition, but I take my job much more seriously than just to oppose things. I know it's our job to put forth ideas. So we've been putting a lot of ideas forward. Getting candidates. We got some great candidates in Cape Breton, especially in Glace Bay with John White there. But just really preparing for an election, that means listening to Nova Scotians to understand what it is, the opportunities they see and the challenges they see. So that's where our focus has been. And I'd say, you know, look, the year's off to a good start.
Sooner or later, there will be a provincial election and there will be a void to fill in the Glace Bay riding. And popular MLA and cabinet minister Jeff McClellan announcing he's not reoffering. How much stock are you putting into that riding? And it will it be difficult to convince voters to vote PC? It's been a Liberal riding for about 20 years now.
Yeah, quite. It has been for quite some time, and I will say that I have a lot of respect for Jeff McClellan. He's a good person, and he's been a good representative for your area, even if it's with the Liberal side. He's a good, just a good guy. But so certainly, look, that opens it up. But we have a fantastic candidate there, in John White. Most people will know John from his volunteer work, from his work with the fire department, from his work through as a teacher at the school. Just really working hard to have a positive impact on the community, because he cares about the community. So I have high hopes for John in that constituency, and I look forward to him representing the people around the table here in Halifax. He'll be a good representative, and I've been up there and spent some time with him on the doorsteps already.
So what are your thoughts on voter turnout? Do you expect it will increase from the previous election because of the pandemic and people maybe wanting to be more engaged with the government to make sure they have the most important, reliable, and the latest information?
It's hard to say. I mean, voter turnout is something that people are we always want more and more people to vote, and provincially in our election across the entire province, the turnout was about 54%, so really only half the people that were eligible to vote voted. So, look, the politicians own some of that. That means that they didn't inspire or motivate the Nova Scotians to get out and vote. And I think, you know, we have to take that seriously. So for me, and the issues that I hear across the province, and especially on the doors in Glace Bay, is around healthcare. So we're very focused on healthcare. We've been putting forth a lot of plans around universal mental health care, dignity for seniors, how we can invest in the long-term care system to make sure our seniors age with dignity, and just hope for health, hope that people can access primary health care, give them hope by putting forward a plan. So I think from listening to people on the doorsteps in Glace Bay, while I've been out with John, healthcare is on their minds, jobs and the economy are too. Those are the two most important things. But I believe if we show that we have a vision for this province and we have a path forward to make sure that people can access healthcare, to make sure that our economy is really seizing the opportunities that are before it, and we have significant opportunities in this province. If we do that, then maybe the voters will be motivated to come out and support John White and help us form a PC government, because I think a PC government is really the way that we can help this province reach its full potential, and we have a lot of potential.
How would you describe your working relationship with the new premier, Ian Rankin? He's a very young man, under 40 years old, and is that working out for you guys?
Yeah, I do find it. Look, Ian Rankin is a good person. I have a lot of time for him. We've obviously sat in the legislature beside, across, whatever the case may be, for 7 years. So his heart is in the right place. I think on the political spectrum, he'd be left of Daryl Dexter. Certainly very far left of Stephen McNeil. So, I mean, that would be his political ideology. But for me, it's like I'm just very, very focused on healthcare, you know, fixing the healthcare system, making sure we have doctors, making sure people can get the care they need, whether it's mental health, primary healthcare, surgery, wait times, all these things. We're laser, laser focused on that. But also knowing that the only way you can pay for healthcare and education and community services and all these things that government has a responsibility to provide to Nova Scotians is with a strong economy. So I think that, you know, the Liberals were on the right track on some of the things that they were doing, but there's tremendous opportunities. And right now, more than ever, with the opportunities that are in front of this province, we've come through COVID with a pretty good ways. And Nova Scotians worked hard to keep our numbers down. Now the government has to do its job to get us our vaccines, and there's a lot of problems with that. But a lot of people have looked at Nova Scotia in a very positive light across Canada, across North America. This is an opportunity for us, and we need a government that can seize that opportunity. I definitely won't hold Ian Rankin's inexperience against him, let's say that. But I do know that there's opportunities for this province that we need to seize.
So malls and fitness facilities are allowing 100% capacity now, and restrictions becoming less at the sports and arts events. And do you agree with that decision? Is it too soon, or is it, you know, do you think it's, well, it's about time. And of course, all Atlantic Canadians now will be able to enter Nova Scotia without self-isolating.
Yeah, I think I would, it's been a long time. It's been a long year, and there's a lot of pent-up energy for people to do more and socialize more and have more kind of more normal. The issue that the government is grappling with, and I know that they're saying all kinds of things to take away from the primary issue, is that they haven't done a good job of getting the vaccines out. Nova Scotia is last in getting people vaccinated. We should never be last in any kind of category like that. We should be leading. So, but if we had more and more people vaccinated, like other jurisdictions, people are now seeing other people in other parts of Canada and other parts of the world, with their vaccines and, you know, kind of feeling a little bit better about life. If we had more of that, then we could, you know, we'd feel more confident opening up. But we don't have that. But the government doesn't want to focus on that. So they start to say other things. Like, can you imagine using a COVID press conference to talk about dogs on patios? Like, there's no better example of a government not wanting to talk about the real issue and instead wanting to talk about something else further. But I know that there's a lot of anxiety. People are having a lot of anxiety. They want to do more and more. It's and well, they can't. It's pushing on their mental health. It's causing a lot of strains in households, strains in families, all kinds of strains. So government is trying to find that balance. But I continue to say the way out of this is vaccine. Let's not be last in the country on vaccines.
And what about the time that it takes to see if a vaccine works correctly?
Yeah, in terms of well, there'll be questions and research required around, you know, the two doses and the time between the two doses. But I think I'm confident in the vaccine because, you know, people raise the question of, well, that was awful quick. Yeah, but it was a condensed timeline to get these vaccines. But the amount of money and the amount of effort that's gone into the research, like every was all hands on deck to get these vaccines. So I believe that the effort and the research was there. I feel confident in that. But you're right in how this goes forward and really, you know, what are you really vaccinated against in terms of can you still be a carrier and stuff? Those types of questions are still out there. But still, step number one, let's get these vaccines in arms. That's a proven protection from at least serious illness in most cases, not all, but certainly in most cases. And so I think we can't be last in the country on that.
So from time to time, provincial parties aren't always on the same page as their federal counterparts. And a perfect example of that involving some discussions at a Conservative Party of Canada meeting last month where the federal Conservatives suggested that climate change is not real or at least not important. And can you talk about your reaction to this situation?
Yeah, I was quite surprised. The debate is closed on that. Obviously, look, Nova Scotia, coastal province, we understand climate change here and in this province, and certainly in the progressive Conservative Party, the PC Party of Nova Scotia. I'm a progressive in the tradition of Stanfield and Ham, and we've been talking about climate change and biodiversity, these things for quite some time. In fact, the PC Party introduced the strongest environmental legislation this province has ever seen when we put in the Environmental Goals and Sustainable Prosperity Act back in 2006. Former Premier McNeil, I heard him on a podcast, and he credited 2006, Nova Scotia 2006 legislation with setting Nova Scotia on the path for reductions of emissions and stuff. Now, he didn't say it was PC legislation. He just referred to it as 2006 legislation, but that's okay. So these types of things around the environment, preserving our planet, these are things that are not, they're not partisan. I mean, I hold them near and dear. My party does, the PC party does, and Nova Scotians do. So I was quite surprised by that. But look, the federal politics, you know, I focus on Nova Scotia. I only focus on improving the lives of Nova Scotians. I'm not involved in federal politics, but I certainly have there's no question in my mind that preserving the planet is a high priority of all Nova Scotians, including mine.
So when you publicly disagree with a federal counterpart like that, are you ever concerned about resentment at that level or, you know, not willing to work things out?
The Nova Scotia PC Party is its own party. We have our own leader. We have our own members. The Conservative Party of Canada, separate party, its own leader, its own members. We agree on certain things. Some things we don't. But for me, it's our party is our party. We're not beholden to anyone else. We're unique like that. Like the Liberals, if you're a Liberal member, you're automatically a member federally and provincially, and you're just one. And same with the NDP, but not with the PC party. They're separate memberships, separate parties. So, I mean, I think wherever you're at in politics, when you take a position, you hope everyone agrees with you. And maybe on some issues, a federal politician on the Conservative side may hope even more that the PCs of Nova Scotia do. But the reality is that I focus on Nova Scotia. That's it. And if I'm fortunate enough to be Premier of this province and the PC party forms a government, whoever the Prime Minister of Canada is can expect that I will be there banging on the door, advocating for Nova Scotia. And I think that's something that's been missing. You know, we've had Liberals in Nova Scotia and Liberals in Ottawa. We haven't, you know, I don't know that Nova Scotia has got its fair share. And I think that's because maybe there's been a little bit too much concern of stepping on somebody's toes. I don't have that concern. I am focused on Nova Scotia, and whoever is governing in Ottawa, they can expect to hear from me about Nova Scotia.
So I know we're running out of time here, Tim, but if we can go back to healthcare for a minute, if your party forms the next government, what's the biggest change Cape Bretoners would see in healthcare?
Well, I think there's really, it's all around providing Nova Scotians, making sure Nova Scotians have access to the right care at the right time in the right place. So, of course, we'd be more opportunities for primary care, you know, doctor, nurse practitioner, virtual, whatever the case may be. Same type of thing with surgical wait times, you know, really getting those surgical wait times down. It's just really shameful to see some of the wait times for those. Universal mental health care is all about making sure that when people need mental health care, they get the right care that they need. So, you know, we put out three very detailed plans. Actually, in the summer, we put out around 20 pages worth of policy around dignity for seniors. People can find that online. Just Google dignity for seniors, Nova Scotia PC Party, or universal mental health. We did that in the fall, same thing. The health care plan, the primary health care plan, you know, doctors, first frontline health care. We put that out in February, launched that right at the regional there in Sydney. So this has been a focus of ours to make sure that we actually explain to Nova Scotians what we think is possible. In fact, a funny story quickly, when I was on doors with Johnny White there, some guy said to me, I know who you are. You're the guy who complains all the time. And I said, no, you must have me mixed up with somebody else, because actually we're putting solutions out. We're not complaining. We're actually talking about what's possible. He said, oh, is that right? And I had a little talk with him, and at the end he said, well, I'm going to check those out then. But his natural inclination was, this is a politician, the opposition going to complain about things. But that's not the way we operate. So I just encourage people just to take a look at the PC party. Take a look at your PC candidate in Glace Bay, in Dominion, that's John White. And I think you'll like what you see. You'll see substance.
That's it for Dialogue on the Coast 89.7 this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue three times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.